counsel for their efforts on the case. And we'll come to the last case of the day, but not the least by any means, U.S. versus Hufstadler, 08-2622. And for the appellant, Mr. Williams. Somebody has to be last. It doesn't mean...
It's all right, Your Honor. I appreciate the break. Good morning, Your Honor. Stephen Williams again, this time for...
A more familiar role for you.
Very much so. Very much so. Seldom do I find myself on that side of the table. This case is no exception. Your Honors, in essence, to be fair here, what we have is a situation where we have we're asserting plain error for the reasons that the district court did not consider what we contest are a development of guidelines that was not based upon the Sentencing Commission's traditional role, but rather were based upon the mandatory minimums that were established by Congress. And so it's the position is analogous to that taken in Kimbrough, and the court is aware that is the basis of the argument. It's analogous to the recent case that just came out of the Supreme Court as well, which reaffirms Kimbrough. On the other hand, we don't have a case that specifically addresses the child pornography sentencing guidelines. Moreover, this was not an issue that was asserted below. We are not asserting in this appeal, while we're not conceding substantive reasonableness, we are not asserting substantive unreasonableness on appeal. So the appeal boils down to asking the court to recognize that that the guideline itself is unreasonable, and requiring that be a recognition that the district courts have to also make. So,
I'm having some difficulty understanding that, though. If you're not contesting the unreasonableness of the sentence, then what does it matter whether the guidelines are reasonable or not? If the 3553A considerations here, and this guy's got a heck of a record and recidivism and touchings involved and so forth, if that's not an unreasonable assessment of what the appropriate sentence is, then what does it matter what the guideline determination was?
I understand the court's point. And certainly we've said in the basis of the appeal is unreasonableness, but this court has made a distinction between procedural unreasonableness and substantive unreasonableness. And I'm trying to frame the issue, I think, that this would be more properly categorized as procedural unreasonableness. And in past opinions, this court has made clear that, for instance, if there is procedural unreasonableness in the calculation of the appropriate advisory guidelines range, that alone can be the basis of a reversal. And so what I'm saying is this is more an attack on the guidelines and the consideration of those guidelines. And so I believe that this would fall within the category more of procedural unreasonableness than it would of substantive unreasonableness, for the reason that it's clear from our appeal, we haven't asserted that the district court didn't take into account Mr. Hufstadler's criminal history. We haven't asserted that the district court gave undue weight to those things. So I don't believe that this particular appeal would be properly categorized as substantive unreasonableness to the extent that you can categorize it as one of those two things. And the reason I say that is because what we're really asking the court to do is require district courts to recognize when a sentencing guideline has not been developed as a consequence of the Sentencing Commission's traditional role, as was the guideline in this case. This case, the sentencing guidelines as they relate to the production of child pornography are keyed to the mandatory minimums. They were developed as a consequence of congressional mandate. There are other guideline provisions within the child pornography ones that are also developed as a result of congressional mandate.
Yeah, and doesn't Congress have the authority to do that, to decide certain things are so serious that they can bump up the mandatory minimums and the maximums to address that, those concerns?
Absolutely. And they have the authority to do that in the crack cocaine cases as well. And that's why the mandatory minimums for crack cocaine have not been reversed by any circuit court for that very reason. Yet, despite that fact, the guidelines ranges that have been established by the Sentencing Commission have been for crack cocaine, have been explicitly called into question by the Supreme Court in Kimbrough, and the analysis and reasoning that the Supreme Court provided in that case boils down to what was the basis for the ranges that have been established by the Sentencing Commission, the 100-to-1 range that was at issue before. And now the kind of mishmash amalgam ranges, but in any event, those are still keyed to the mandatory minimums. And so when it was a 100-to-1 range, it was simply, we're going to put the bottom of each guideline range right where it would, where the mandatory minimum would be. And so similarly, in this particular case, you have guidelines ranges that are established by Congress and keyed to mandatory minimums, and not keyed to the Sentencing Commission's study of what an appropriate sentence should be based upon the, you know, years of comparison and court practice, et cetera. So that's where the analogy comes in. And I would certainly agree. The Congress has a right to set the mandatory minimums, and they can weigh in on what the guidelines ranges should be. But the Supreme Court has said that in those circumstances, at least with respect to crack cocaine, we need not give those guidelines the kind of deference we would give to other types of guidelines
but
provisions.
In this case, the district court didn't give the guidelines a lot of deference. I mean, you thought a higher sentence was important.
A fair point.
Doesn't that really, end the case?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And here's why. I think that because of the fact that the court always, and Judge Gilbert and all the other judges, they begin with the guidelines. And generally, their determinations, like in many district courts, start from the guidelines and then figure on what is a sentence that is adequate with respect to the guidelines range being a starting point. The degree of variance is often the calculus that is going on from our perspective and our position in the judge's mind. And that, of course, in fairness, stems from a long history of years where the guidelines are mandatory, but I don't think we've gotten past that point. Well, because what normally we have is we've got a guidelines range. If the court is going to give a non-guideline sentence, in the average case, and I think in almost every case, this still the calculus that goes on in the judge's mind is, if I take what the base range is here, how much more do I have to go over it to really reflect the seriousness of the offense? And so the sentences still are so keyed to the guidelines that this still becomes an important issue, and it still is in this case. Now, I recognize that when you look at the language that Judge Gilbert used in the sentencing transcript, I think it is ambiguous as to whether or not specifically he was engaging in that intellectual process or analytical process of keying a variance to where the guidelines range was to begin with. But that certainly has been the history, and that is certainly also required that you go through this analysis first. So that's why our position is based upon, even in this case, that you've got a sentence that still has that guidelines range as a starting point, and it's still an important aspect of the sentence. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Luggins?
Good morning, Your Honors. Tom Luggins on behalf of the United States. I believe the question Judge Ripple asked is the most pertinent one, because one of the things that the defendant has to show in this case in order to get relief under Olano, under a plain error standard, is that any potential error affected his substantial rights. And in the record in this case, that's going to be impossible for this defendant to show, because the district court was very clear that he believed the sentence of 450 months was entirely appropriate, regardless of what the mandatory minimum said and regardless of what the guidelines said. And to take it one step back in the Olano analysis, the defendant cannot show that there is any clear or obvious error in this case. There's no other case in the country, or no other circuit court case in the country, that would have given the district court any kind of guidance that a Kimbrough analysis applies to the child obscenity guidelines. And the final point I would make is just a practical one. The defendant is asking this court to basically declare the child obscenity guidelines of as having less force and effect under a Kimbrough analysis. That is, I believe, ill-advised under a plain error analysis. I can tell this court that this very same issue is coming up over and over again in the district courts. It's being done in the context of where a record is being made by both sides. A very extensive record is certainly being made by the government. The last case I'm aware of, there was a 75-page memorandum filed on this issue. So I would just make the practical point that if this court is going to decide this issue, it would be more advisable to do it in the context of a de novo review where an adequate record has been made by both sides. And if there are no questions, I will yield the rest of my time.
Thank you. And how much time left for rebuttal? Mr. Williams?
Your Honors, I really have nothing further to add, but I was losing the case name of the recent Supreme Court case, and it's Spears is the case that I was referring to. Thank you, Your Honors.
You have the rest of the day off.
Yes, you're done. And we're done. That concludes the calendar, and we will be in recess taking this case.